negotiations. Most of us will find ourselves negotiating in one form or another on a regular basis. However, few people really master the art of negotiation. We at I Love Real Estate believe that mastering negotiation means also mastering communication. There is a distinction between negotiation and communication, and the definitions for each, according to the Oxford Dictionary, are as follows. Negotiation is discussion aimed at reaching an end. Communication is the evoking, imparting, or exchanging of a shared common meaning to another person, either by speaking, writing, or using some other medium. It is interesting to look at the history of communication. Speech was developed about 200,000 years ago. Symbols were developed about 30,000 years ago, whereas writing was developed 7,000 years ago. Communication can be broken down into these three areas: oral communication, written communication, and non-verbal communication. To be an effective communicator, and therefore negotiator, it is important to hone your skills in these three types of communication. It is the evolution of brain function that differentiates humans from animals, and among other things, also allows humans to master a very effective form of communication, speech. There has been quite a lot of research done over the years into effective communication. Results show that what you hear, the tone of your voice, your vocal clarity, and your verbal expressiveness represents 40% of your message. What you see or feel, your facial expression, your appearance, dress and grooming, your posture, your eye contact, your touch, and your gestures represents 50% of your message, and your words represent the other 10% of the message. When it comes to communication and negotiation, you have to be mindful of your complete package, not just what you're actually going to say. Research also shows the importance of understanding how much of the communication or exchange the other person actually retains. Results from this research show that people generally retain 10% of what they read, 20% of what they hear, 30% of what they see, 50% of what they see and hear, 70% of what they say, and 90% of what they say and do. This is why in medical school, the philosophy for teaching medical students how to perform a procedure is 1. Learn by watching and be guided by the teacher, doctor, surgeon. 2. Then perform the procedure under the guidance of the teacher, doctor, surgeon. And 3. Then teach someone else how to perform the procedure. This three-step process has been proven to be the most effective way of really learning. Let's look at the following principles of positive cooperative communication. Soften your tone in order to avoid sounding pushy. Rephrase your words to avoid sounding opinionated and superior. For example, instead of saying, "you'll have to," you could say, "could you," or "would you be able to?" Always be solution-focused. Instead of saying, "this block can't be subdivided," look at things differently and ask, "how can I build two houses on this block?" I had this very example recently on one of my properties. I wanted to subdivide the property into multiple lots, but the council town planner said the property could not be subdivided. However, by asking the right question, that is, "how can I build multiple dwellings on the property?" I achieved a better answer. I can actually build 8 houses on the property, and no, it can't be subdivided, but I can still achieve my higher objective of having multiple income streams from the property. Turn cannots into cans. Instead of saying, "I can't do that until next week," say, "I'll be able to do that next week." See how the whole connotation and emotion around the sentence changes simply by dropping the word "can't"? Take responsibility. Blame is one of the most debilitating responses. When you blame someone or a situation, you are actually putting yourself down. This comes back to principle 4, be solution focused. Instead of jumping to "it's not my fault" immediately, turn to "what can I do to fix that?" Or even better, "here's what I can do to fix that." Responsibility is much higher on the evolutionary hierarchy than blame. It is what distinguishes leaders from followers and success from mediocrity. Say what you want, not what you don't want. This works on your subconscious as much as your conscious brain. Instead of saying, "don't drive too fast," say instead, "drive carefully." When talking to your town planner, better to say, I want the most cost-effective and time-efficient application, than I don't want a long, drawn-out, costly application process. Additionally, always ask directly for what you want. This may seem obvious, but so many people beat around the bush for fear of appearing stupid or not wanting to offend the other person. Remember, if you don't ask, you already have a no. Focus on the future, not the past. This principle interrelates with the other principles. Instead of blaming and focusing on the can'ts, or looking at the problem instead of the solution, you need to focus on your future desired outcome. Instead of saying, we've been over this before, I don't want, say instead, okay, from now on, I want whatever. Share information rather than argue or accuse. This is something that comes with maturity. I said maturity, not age. You can be mature and still quite young. The more confident and secure you are, the less you will feel the need to convince others that you are right. You know you're right, regardless of the opinion of others. Those that feel the need to make someone else agree can be confrontational, and this is not congruent to a mutually agreeable outcome. Communication, and definitely negotiation, is about mutual agreement, not a win-lose-victory war. Learn the art of effective listening. In order to be a good communicator and negotiator, you must first learn to be a good listener. There is a very good quote by Mark Twain that sums it up perfectly. If you were supposed to talk more than listen, you would have been born with two mouths and one ear. Negotiating is like being in a play. You have four roles to play. You are the detective, the lawyer, the judge, and the accountant. Let me explain. As the detective, you need to investigate your opponent, the situation, and the property, and find out as much as you can about all three. As the lawyer, you need to be able to present the other side's case better than they can. Once you can do that, then you have prepared your case because you, like any good lawyer, will be in a position to predict the other side's objections before they open their mouths. As the judge, you enter the bargaining phase. What do good judges do? They listen to all information presented before making a decision. A good judge will know that occasionally the negotiator will become emotional and distort the facts. By wearing your judge's hat or wig, you can emotionally keep your distance. As the accountant, you cast your eye to the detail. Accountants check everything carefully, being alert to inconsistencies. This will be in the agreement phase. The temptation in the agreement phase is to heave a sigh of relief and think, thank goodness the haggling is over, and relax. Yet this is exactly what you shouldn't do. This is where the facts, figures, and contracts all need to be checked very carefully. It is in this phase that a lot of add-ons get put into agreements. Remember, ears tend to have lousy memories, so it is best to follow up everything in writing. Key steps to an ideal negotiation process. Whilst working on your language skills is important to the overall outcome of a negotiation, there is actually a process to successful negotiation that has been tried and tested and proven to be the most effective and successful negotiation process. 1. Gather information. The more you know about anything, the better the decisions you make. Consequently, before entering into any form of negotiation, it is vitally important to find out as much about the situation as possible. Life is really one big negotiation. However, in the context of real estate, we are usually negotiating as either a buyer or a seller, negotiating with tradespeople, negotiating with agents, negotiating with counsel, etc. And your motto really should be, forewarned is forearmed. Find out as much information about the buyer or the seller or the other party's motivation as you can before you start negotiating. If you understand what their motivation is, it becomes much easier to structure an argument and the deal such that it is appealing to their needs while still satisfying your own. It is always a good idea to ask third-level questions. By that, we mean ask questions that on the surface may seem irrelevant to the negotiation. However, they help form a complete picture of the other party's motivation. During this process, it is also advisable to keep in mind any cultural differences or idiosyncrasies that may affect the negotiation. An example of this might be Chinese lucky numbers and trying to avoid the letter 4 whilst incorporating the letter 8. These days, it is an absolute must to Google your opponent. There is so much online these days about everybody, and a lot can be gained by joining the Google Dots. For instance, in a buyer-seller situation, it helps to understand the psyche of the other party, even to whether they have kids, whether they travel a lot, what age they are, what their hobbies are, etc. A lot of this can be gained from social media like Facebook. This can add a layer of understanding about associations and allegiances the other party may have. It helps when building a relationship with the other party to establish rapport and understanding prior to the tactical process of negotiation. For example, if after looking at Facebook, you find your seller is a grandparent and that he or she is looking at moving interstate, and this may help you structure a longer settlement so they have time to find another house closer to the kids and the grandkids. Or if through social media you find the seller spends quite a bit of time caravanning around Australia, this could mean they don't need the money from the sale of the property straight away, and maybe they would like to be paid a regular monthly income while travelling, thus giving you an opportunity to subdivide, renovate, or gain development approval on the property prior to purchase. The old adage, knowledge is power, is certainly the case when it comes to negotiation. Find out information about the property and what other properties the buyer or seller may own. This can also be useful information. Subscription-based programs such as Real Estate, Investar, RP Data and Price Finder, APM, which is included in Investar, will provide details on how much a seller paid for a property, how long ago, when it was originally listed for sale or rent, and whether the property has been previously reduced in price, and even what other properties that person owns. Information is massive and can be crucial to you structuring the deal, price, terms, etc. 2. Create a plan. Now that you have gathered the required information about your opponent, you need to structure the plan for the negotiation. This involves thinking through and writing what the other party needs out of the negotiation and what you need from the negotiation. Making a list of the motivating factors of the other party. Writing a list of triggers you believe are the most important factors for your opponent and for yourself. Making a list of potential objections or barriers that the other party may have and determine a plan of attack to counter these objections. Sketching up a plan of how you are going to present the deal. This deal could be a plan to a tradesperson or concept to a town planner or council or a joint venture proposition. Knowing your bottom line pull-out figure. Part of being a good negotiator is also knowing when to walk away. By preparing beforehand, you know exactly what that point is and whether it be price or conditions. Identifying the party you are negotiating with from a character perspective. Are they someone who needs to be coached and cajoled? Are they a driver and just want to cut to the chase? Are they someone who is going to make a calculated and considered decision, or are they someone who acts on emotion? These factors are important when planning the approach you need to take in the negotiation. The best negotiators are chameleons. They can adapt and change the situation depending on who they are dealing with. Working through possible outcomes, you will have your realistic outcome, an acceptable outcome, and a worst-case scenario outcome. Come up with creative options to deal with potential objections or barriers put up by the other party. Addressing your reasons for doing this deal. Ask yourself why you are doing the deal and make sure your emotions are not running away with you. 3. Relationship building. This is where the benefit of your third level questioning really comes into its own. More deals are done as a result of strong relationships than are ever done on just price. Understand the differences and similarities between yourself and the other party and try to create rapport. This can be done verbally as well as non-verbally. Non-verbal communication can actually be much stronger than the verbal communication. This will be covered later in the chapter. From a verbal communication perspective, at least try and be interested in the things that are important to the other party, even if you have to brush up on some knowledge on the topic you know nothing about. A great example of this is when Ian was creating a relationship with a real estate agent in the area where he wanted to purchase a property. He asked the agent what she did on the weekend. She replied she had been in a camp drafting competition. Being the city boy that he is, Ian had no idea what camp drafting was. After a quick YouTube and Google search, the next time he spoke to her, he had enough general knowledge on the subject to ask some intelligent questions and further strengthen their rapport and relationship. 4. Presentation phase. The most important thing to remember in the presentation phase is to use simple, clear diction. Don't ramble on, don't mumble, and don't use big words. You are not there trying to impress an elocution class. You are there to get the job done. Here is an example of what we are talking about. Remember when Newton sat under the apple tree and got hit on the head by a falling apple and discovered the law of gravity? Well, he didn't sit there and say, "Yes, well, here I am sitting under a 26-year-old tree with red apples about 8 centimetres in diameter, one of which has fallen very quickly, impacted on my scalp, and caused an immediate sensation of pain." He was probably more likely to have said, "Which redneck threw that blasted apple?" Concise and to-the-point communication is much more effective, and being clear and concise comes with preparation. The more preparation you have done and the more you have planned out your constructive approach, the easier it is for you to negotiate efficiently. 5. Bargaining phase. This phase is often the most difficult to prepare for. In your preparation work, you have listed out the potential outcomes, what the other party may or may not say, and what your response would be if they said this or that. However, you can never truly prepare for this part of the negotiation. You have to be flexible. You have to think on your feet. It is in this phase that your reading of the non-verbal communication is important. This part of the negotiation is more like a game of poker, where different tactics work better than others depending on your opponent. Here are some tactics to consider. Emotional outburst. I'm not a big fan of this, as it doesn't suit my personality. However, I have seen it used very effectively by someone with the right persona. It is normally an indication that the person having the emotional outburst wants to exert power for a short, intense period of time. Of course, once the other party is aware of the ruse, it loses all impetus. Of course, if the emotional outburst is genuine and from anger, then often things are said which should never have been uttered, but cannot be taken back. Arguing a specific point. This is often used to clarify a specific part of the negotiation. If you are the one using this tactic, you do it to gain ground on the point so that subsequent topics become less of an obstacle. For example, let's say you are negotiating for a long settlement. Once this point has been agreed upon, it is easy for you to ask for things during this long settlement period, such as early access or consent to lodge a development application with counsel. If you are on the receiving end of this tactic, then you do not want to agree to any minor part until such time as you have the full picture presented to you. Pretending ignorance. This tactic has been used for centuries by politicians. From a negotiation standpoint, it is normally used to draw out or extract more information from the other party in the early stages of negotiation. If this tactic is being used against you, the best response is for you to only answer the question at hand without volunteering a lot of other information. The key here is to answer the question, and only the question, then shut up. This normally comes from being confident. Typically, someone who is nervous or lacking self-confidence is the one that will rabbit on and become very chatty, and in doing so, give away far more information than they should have. Environment. Strategically, being in your own environment is your home court advantage. If you are ever in a corporate negotiation and you are in your opponent's offices and they leave you in a small room for 15 to 20 minutes prior to the meeting, you had better make sure your senses are very alert, because what they are actually doing is they are preparing you for sacrifice. It's a bit like a football match where the home team always has the advantage. You go first. Who goes first can be a bit of a dilemma. It is often why unprepared negotiators spend a lot of time doing small talk. Each one is avoiding the elephant in the room or the deal at hand. As a general rule, if you are well prepared, it is better to go first. This will typically cut down unnecessary time wasting. The red herring. The red herring is a point that you would make a really big deal out of and make out that it is the most important part of the deal, yet in reality, it is of little or no importance. It is a sacrificial lamb. Here is an example. Let's say you are bargaining to buy a property and you make a big deal out of the fact that you must have a 90-day settlement, and through negotiation you get the seller to come down significantly in price in exchange for giving you up to a 90-day settlement. The seller feels like they have had a win because you gave up something which on the surface appeared to be very important to you, yet in reality the 90-day settlement was just the red herring. The ultimatum. The ultimatum is really a bullying tactic, again, not one I particularly like. The downside of using the ultimatum is the other side may very well call your bluff and you have to be prepared to walk away. The ultimatum really only works when you have a desperate opponent on the other side, and since I don't like taking advantage of anyone, this is not a tactic that should be given any weight. Timing. Timing is crucial to successful negotiation. Understanding how much time the other party has or needs is very important to how the negotiation transpires. If you have a very motivated seller or buyer, then speed of settlement and fewer conditions are the things that need to be stressed in the negotiation, and the other parts of the deal can be more flexible, such as price. I remember hearing about a negotiator who went to Japan to negotiate a merger for our company. This was when I was back in my days as a young accountant. The negotiator had a week to conduct his business. The Japanese were very good hosts, and on his arrival in Tokyo, they politely took the airline ticket to confirm his return flight. Well, of course, now they had control over his time. You guessed it. They filled his week with niceties such as dinners and sightseeing and kept putting off the actual negotiation of the company. Because they knew the time of his return flight, the real negotiation did not take place until they were on their way back to the airport. This is a classic rookie error. The nibble. This is a classic tactic used usually towards the end of the negotiation. It is normally a small thing that is thrown in order to get a bigger point of negotiation across the line. For instance, as a seller, you may say, if you meet my price, I'll throw in the furniture package. This will normally cost you a lot less than the reduction in price they were seeking. Or as a buyer, you may say, okay, I'll meet your price, but I want the furniture as well, or the tractor, or lawnmower, or the boat, or whatever. The higher authority. This is a cunning tactic. It is usually used to buy time. I can't make a decision now because I have to ask my wife, my lawyer, or whoever. You buy time to deliberate exactly what's on the table and ensure you do not have to make a rushed decision. Real estate agents hate this. It gives the buyer or the seller time to back out of the deal, which of course means they don't get their commission. Silence. Some negotiators call this the gap. He who speaks first usually loses. Again, this tactic takes confidence because it is a show of strength and it usually follows a significant offer or point. The waiting can be agonizing, but you need to hold your ground. If you find that you are doing more than 50% of the talking, watch out that the other person isn't using your loose lips to find out how far they can push you. If you ask a question and fail to get an answer from the other side, don't jump in and answer for them, as you will end up giving away more than you bargained for. Filling the silence by answering your own question lets the other side know very quickly where you stand and how vulnerable you are. Ask a question, then keep quiet. Do a memorandum of understanding. When an agreement has been reached on various points in a deal, it is really important to capture the agreement in writing. I like to do this by taking out pen and paper, writing the words memorandum of understanding on the top of the page, and then listing in dot point everything that has been agreed so far. You will find that the other party will start adding their 2 cents worth into the document. This is good news, because when the memorandum of understanding is complete, you have a clear written document that describes what has been agreed upon, and the other party will have acknowledged, and in most cases contributed to the document. Preferably, you then write the words at the bottom of the page. This is intended to be a binding contract, and then you both sign. Unfortunately, the days of a handshake are well and truly gone. You need to have things in writing. While this document may not necessarily stand up in court, it certainly goes a long way from a commitment and psychological perspective to finalising the deal. This document also forms a good basis for the lawyers to draw up the actual contract. Some people like to record a conversation which summarises the agreement. I find this can be quite confronting for the other party, and they are not as free with the information as you would like them to be if they were being recorded. As an absolute must, if the memorandum of understanding is not completed during a face-to-face negotiation, then you should always follow up the negotiation with an email confirming what has been agreed on. This email should contain something to the effect, please advise by return email if any of the points above mentioned are not your understanding of our conversation. good cop, bad cop. This tactic really shouldn't need much explanation if you have watched television over the last 20 years. If you are working as a team, the tactic still can be quite effective, but don't make it too obvious, because this tactic is so well known, you need to be quite subtle for it to be an effective tactic. Research shows that the styles of negotiations have changed over the years. From 1970 to 1985, negotiation was about a power play. From 1985 to 2000, negotiation was more of a side-by-side problem-solving exercise. And from 2000 onwards, negotiation has become more of a learning conversation exercise. Body language. Studies have indicated that approximately 50% of our communication is from non-verbal cues. Therefore, it is necessary to consider this aspect of communication and, in fact, negotiation as well. You could be saying everything the correct way, listening and responding by the textbook, but if your body language is wrong, then you still may not get the desired result. The biggest part of being an effective body language communicator is to be authentic and energetically aligning with the other person. Unfortunately, this style of learning comes from the University of Life experience rather than textbooks. Remember, body language is not an exact science. No single body language sign is a reliable indicator. It is the interpretation of several consistent signals that would indicate a particular meaning or intention. The way we react to people's eyes, movement, focus, expression, etc., and their subsequent reactions to us, contribute to this interpretation and understanding both consciously and subconsciously. Much can be communicated using no words at all. A look, a raised eyebrow, a smirk, a wink, all have very powerful meanings. Understanding body language will give you significant advantage in a negotiation situation. You see, understanding body language is not just reading the signals in other people, it is also understanding your own body language, which enables better self-awareness and self-control. Posture and positioning is also important. For example, if you are trying to convey equality, sit or stand at right angles to the person and, where possible, sit or stand at the same level. Open hand gestures give a feeling of trust. Keep all movements relaxed and flowing, not jerky and quick, which could indicate nervousness and ultimately that you have something to hide. Keep your attention exclusively on the other person. Having a scattered attention could show disrespect and lack of interest in what the other person is saying. Generally, leaning slightly forward to the other person shows interest. Leaning back shows rejection or disapproval. Maintain good eye contact while listening to encourage the speaker to keep divulging information. Increasing eye contact can apply more pressure, and reducing eye contact can lower pressure. Always respond directly to what the other person has said. Even repeating part or all of their statement shows or confirms your attention to their needs in the negotiation. Always respect people's personal space zones. This can also be a cultural thing, as people from Asian descent tend to stand much closer than those from European descent. 6. Closing phase. Once all the bargaining tricky bits have been sorted out, it is now time to close the deal. The best way to do this is by summarising everything that has been agreed to so far. As indicated earlier, we believe this is best done in writing. However, don't delay the close to a later time, just so that you can confirm everything in writing. As I said earlier, I prefer to handwrite a memorandum of understanding on the spot. By handwriting and summarising all of the points to the deal, you reinforce agreement on each of the points to the deal. Even the slowness of handwriting adds to the concrete nature of the agreement. It gives the other side an opportunity to add to the mutual agreement. When the memorandum of understanding is all written out and both parties agree to its content, write the words on the bottom. This is intended to be a binding contract, and both parties should sign. 7. Summarising and debriefing phase. Whenever you have completed the task, it's always a good idea to conduct a post-mortem. A post-mortem or review of your performance and how the deal went down is your opportunity to learn from your mistakes so that you don't repeat them again, and recognise the things you did well so you can include them in your regular negotiation patterns. Ask yourself some questions such as, what can I learn from that particular negotiation? What would I do differently if I had the opportunity to negotiate that deal again? What other things could I do or could I have done to get a better result? As usual, having these questions and answers actually written down and filed away either digitally or manually in a file gives you the opportunity to go back and review at a future date. This is just good business sense. The more negotiations you do, the better you can become. So don't beat yourself up if you stuff up a few times to start with. It's just practice, practice, practice. Options. The options strategy is probably something you relate to the share market. However, writing options in the real estate market can be a very lucrative process if you know what to look for and have the knowledge and foresight to see the potential in a property. Market trends do affect the profitability of options and the ease with which they can be traded. For instance, when the financial markets are tight and borrowing money to develop is harder, selling an option deal to a builder or developer is more difficult. However, in this type of climate, it is often easier to negotiate the option contract on the property, as buyers are normally fewer and further between. So in hard times, it is easier to get an option, but harder to sell. Okay, so what is an option? It is basically the right, but not the obligation, to buy or sell a property at an agreed price at a future point in time. For some people, options are this big scary thing, but in reality, an option is just a stack of papers that gives you the right to certain things. Having said this, it's still a great tool. The option agreement is simply a legal document that the buyer and seller both sign, and it is then attached to a contract. The option agreement is your right to do something, but possibly not the obligation to. An option is merely a document that a seller and a buyer, or potential buyer, sign. It's an agreement to transact. Let's take a step back and explain the different types of options. A put option. A put option is commonly called a seller's option. It gives the seller the right, but not the obligation within an agreed time frame, to put the sale contract to a lawyer, and the buyer must proceed with the purchase. This type of option is very rarely used on its own. Call option. A call option is commonly called a buyer's option. It gives the buyer the right, but not the obligation within an agreed time frame, to call on the seller to proceed with the purchase contract. Call options are quite common and are the main type of option you will be negotiating. Put and call option. A put and call option is basically a combination of the two. When signing a put and call option, both buyer and seller are effectively signing an unconditional contract, and both buyer and seller must settle on the property. Generally, you need to give the seller something in exchange for taking his property off the market while you renovate and gain council approvals and whatever else you need to do to the property. The trade-off is usually money. You pay a premium price for the property and don't have to settle for an extended period of time, or if at all. An option contract is not as well understood as a purchase contract, and the thought of entering into an option contract will scare people if they don't know what they are, or have never seen them or heard of them. There are some markets that are better for using option contracts than others. Let's go through how applicable an option contract is in different markets. Residential. Using option contracts in the residential market is actually the hardest to do successfully. This is mainly due to the lack of knowledge on the part of mum and dad sellers. You may be wanting to secure a number of houses side by side so you can build a block of units or get a DA for a block of units or a childcare centre, etc. You don't want to proceed with any of the opportunities unless you can get all of the current owners to agree to sell. This situation is perfect for using an option agreement. An option gives you the ability to proceed and buy the properties or sell options to a builder or developer if you can get them all. But if one seller won't sell, then the whole deal is off and you can simply choose not to exercise your option and walk away. The best way to get mum and dad sellers to agree to an option is to personally sit down with them and explain what the different documents mean, and in doing so, it is best not to use legal terms. For the most part, you probably shouldn't use the word option agreement if you feel they are not familiar with it. Residential or commercial for DA. An option is the document you would use if you wanted to buy a property only if you could get a satisfactory development approval on the property. The option agreement gives you control over the property while you apply for the necessary approvals. As previously stated, you normally pay a premium price in order to control the property whilst you apply to the council for the necessary approvals. The power of attorney clauses in your option agreement allow you to fill out the paperwork for the council approvals and sign on the seller's behalf to gain the necessary approvals. Commercial. As mentioned in the previous point, commercial property can be optioned for the purpose of DA, but there's another reason you may want to option a commercial property, particularly a vacant commercial property. Unlike residential property, the value of commercial property is directly proportionate to its rental yield, whereas a residential property's value is based on comparable sales of similar properties in similar condition in a similar area. For a commercial property, the higher the rent, the longer the lease, the bigger, more secure the tenant, the greater the value of your property. Commercial properties are valued on a cap rate, a capitalisation rate. In major cities closer to CBDs, the cap rate might be 6 to 8%, whereas in more regional areas, the cap rate might be more like 10 to 13%. Cap rate is really another word for percentage yield. Let me give you an example. If you had a commercial property returning $100,000 a year income at an 8% cap rate, the value of your property would be $1.25 million. $100,000 divided by 8% is $1.25 million. However, if the same property was in a more regional area where the cap rate is 13%, the value of your property would be $769,230. $100,000 divided by 13% is $769,230. Remember, with commercial property, the tenants pay the outgoings in most leases. Therefore, the income you are getting is net income with little or no expenses, other than interest, to come out of it. Let's take that thought process further. A vacant property will be considerably undesirable for most investors, but the right person, someone with an outgoing, motivated, entrepreneurial personality who is prepared to be proactive in finding a tenant, could put an option on the property to purchase it in 1 to 2 years' time at a fixed price. Think of it from the seller's perspective. He has a vacant property, he can't get a tenant, he could be paying interest or a loan, and he could be hurting. Someone comes to him with an offer like, I'll agree to buy your property at X dollars, and we can sign an option agreement here today to that effect. But I need a 2-year time frame. However, in the meantime, I am prepared to lease the property from you so I can fix the property up and make it more suitable for me. In the lease agreement that you sign, you need to have sublease provisions so you could then rent to someone else. You could even tell the seller that whilst you don't want to rent it yourself, you will find someone else to rent it from him during the 2-year period. Now imagine you get into the property, clean it up, renovate, paint, landscape, put up signage, possibly break the building down into smaller rentable components and market the property like crazy to businesses for rent. I have a friend who does exactly this. He's an ex-commercial agent who gets a tenant into the vacant property in good, long-term, well-worded leases, and as soon as the property is fully tenanted, he will exercise his option and possibly even get full financing from the bank. This is because there is such a marked difference between his option price and the new value of the property due to the full occupancy and his having completed the renovation on the property. Whilst this strategy is not for everybody, for the right person with the right personality and who is keen on commercial properties, it is a fabulous high cash flow, high growth strategy with potentially very little or even zero risk. Generally, it is easier to negotiate an option contract with another business person than it is to try and explain the process to a mum and dad seller. Options are ideal for potential subdivision properties, potential strata title properties, potential rezoning properties, potential unit development properties, potential rezoning properties, properties in potential high growth areas, properties that could potentially be zoned for specific use, for example, childcare centres, pubs, taverns, etc. So let's look at it from the other side. Why would a seller agree? There are many ways that you might actually negotiate an option agreement, because an option agreement is as flexible as you can possibly imagine it. But here's a couple of ways you might negotiate an option agreement with the seller and why a seller might sign one. What you're asking them to do is give you more time because you might not want to transact on that property for another year or 2 years, so you have to give them something to buy that time. So what do you give them? You may not even proceed with it, so they've got to get something out of it. This is what you need to do. Option one might be, let's say we've got a property for $800,000. That's what it's worth today. Let's say you intend to get a DA on it, and it would then be worth more because of the DA. That's the plan of attack. You might go to the seller and say, look, I want a contract on the property, and we both agree that it's an $800,000 property. But the reality is that the seller might not need all that money right now. For instance, he might only need part of that money to pay for his daughter's wedding or something. You say, okay, since you don't need all the money now, I'm going to give you, say, $20,000 right now, or it might be $50,000, or it might be more. And that is your money. I'm going to release that to you immediately. You can take that money, you can keep it. You can spend it on whatever you want to spend it on. It is your money. But in exchange for that, I want 2 years in which to settle. Maybe you only need 1 year, or whatever you need to negotiate. What you have done is bought a year or two in time, and in that time you are able to get the DA. You say, when we settle on this property in 2 years' time, I'm then going to give you $780,000 because the money that I'm paying you now will go towards the purchase at the end. Then you say, if I walk away from the contract, then you've got the $20,000 to keep. That money is yours and you've still got the property. That's just one way of negotiating, and it's probably a little bit weaker, I think, than the next one. Option two might be, you say to the seller, you've got this property at $800,000 and we both agree that that's the fair price of the property today. I'm going to pay you $900,000 for the property, but in exchange for paying you more, I want a year or 2 years to settle on the property. Now, right here today, I'm going to give you $1 just to make this legal. I'll give you $1 today, and when we settle on this property in a year's time, I'm going to pay you $900,000. It's a lot more than the value of the property today, and if I walk away, there is no harm done. You still have the property. You're still living there. You're still doing whatever, and I am willing to pay more to get that time and everything in between. You may still have to give them some money up front as well. This depends on how well you negotiate. There are a few tricks in here. The first thing is that the dollar for starters would be called an option fee, and the $20,000 would be a security deposit in advance so as to reduce stamp duty. This is explained in more detail in the next section. It is a little bit different in Victoria because there you have to do it as a joint venture agreement, among other things. Let's say you go and get your DA, and with the DA, the property is now worth $1.2 million. Of course, this DA acquisition would have cost you some money too. With this in place in a year's time, or a year and a half's time, you can probably go to the financier and say, look, this was a long-term agreement. It was over 12 months. It's worth $1.2 million today. You could potentially fund this property to buy it at 80% of the $1.2 million. Potentially. Not always, but potentially. It depends on the market and how free money is at the time. The second thing is that you might get the DA approval and then go, I actually can't complete the deal. I'm going to sell it to a builder for $1.2 million because that's what the property is worth with a DA on it. We should look at the stamp duty implications here through this process. Let's say you sell it to a builder. Up front, regardless of which option you take, you will be paying stamp duty on $1 and paying for the development approval and everything else on the property. You increase the value of the property up to $1.2 million. You sell it to a builder. The builder buys it for $1.2 million. He pays stamp duty on the $1.2 million as normal. That's what he's going to have to pay anyway. And when he cuts the check, his check will be, say, $780,000 or $900,000, depending on which option agreement you negotiated with the previous owner, and the balance would come to you. Yay. I'll give you a real example. I had a client in Brisbane called Mario. To give you some background, Mario had just come out of his fourth divorce and didn't have a cracker to his name. If you want to go broke fast, get divorced. He negotiated on this commercial property that was for sale for $1.4 million through an option agreement. He had no hope of being able to pay for it at that point in time, but it was a vacant commercial property. In the option agreement, he put in all of these clauses that enabled him to fix it up, as well as giving him the ability to gain DA approval from the council. He was then also able to tenant the property, and what he agreed with the owner of the property was that any rent he received during the option period would be split 50-50. Because he was buying it vacant, the current owner was happy because he was not receiving any rent at all. The first thing he did was clean up the front of it. It was a long, thin property, so he put a bit of a shed up and he rented the front of the property to a car yard. Immediately, he was receiving commercial rent on that, which gave him an income stream. It sounds good so far, doesn't it? He then went through the process and got a subdivision approval. Actually, once he got the tenant in place, he brought in a joint venture partner into the option agreement, and the joint venture partner paid for the subdivision. Then together, they got a building approval and licensing approval for the back part of the block, and as soon as those approvals came through, the value of the property with the approvals and the subdivision in place increased up to something like about $4 million. At this point, because he had a joint venture partner, he owned 50% of it, $2 million worth. They purchased the property under the conditions of the option agreement. He had money now. He had an income stream. He had money coming in. They then went ahead and built on the back and started operating a business on the back of the property. With the license and with the business operation, the renovations, as well as everything else, the whole thing was revalued at close to $9.6 million. Do you know what the business was? A brothel. Seriously, it was a brothel. I only told you that story because an option agreement secured the deal. Now let's have a look at some of the special clauses that need to go into those option agreements. Some of the common special clauses are subject to development approval, subject to due diligence, when you just want to find out whether you can actually use the property for what you want to use it for or have it approved for. Builder's terms. In some instances, you can wrap up a property and agree to build a house on there, but you don't pay for it until such time as you've actually on-sold the package to a third party. This is pertinent to builders and particularly the case for new estates. Developers want buildings up as quickly as possible, so they'll do deals where provided you put a building on the block within a certain time frame, you don't have to pay for the land until you actually on-sold that property. Timeframes. You've got to make sure the date of expiration for the exercising of the option is long enough. Give yourself plenty of time. If you think getting a DA approval is going to take you, say, a year, make it a year and a half, or make it 2 years to give yourself plenty of time in case things go wrong. Because the last thing you want to do is go and spend money on the property, get it to a certain stage, and then go, I've got my option, it's going to expire in a month's time, and I haven't got my approvals through, and I haven't been able to sell it. In this case, you've either got to buy the property or try to negotiate an extension of the option. If you've increased the value of the property in that space of time, the likelihood of being able to negotiate an extension on the option is very slim. Access. There needs to be a clause to cover access to the property. Insurance. Designate who is responsible for insurance on the property. Rates. Stipulate who pays the rates on the property. Rental income. With any income that's coming in, does it go to the previous owners or does it go to you? Or like Mario, is it split because you got the tenant? Underlying all this, the documents actually are very technical documents. There's a lot of mechanics with how it should work. There are a lot of tricky points with it, so you do need to have it tailored to your specific circumstances to make sure, again, your rights and interests are protected. The exercise of the option is also a very, very technical process because don't forget that you've improved the value of the property, and seeing this over time, the seller may have seller's remorse. You want to make sure that whatever you lock in on day one is absolute and don't care how they feel in day 10. Option clauses. An option contract is normally accompanied by a written sales contract. This sales contract is conditional upon the exercising of the option contract. As part of the Ultimate series, there is a comprehensive webinar on purchase contracts and option contracts, so it's worth going to the Ultimate members website and re-listening to the webinar. I do not recommend ever using standard documents. You should always have a lawyer specifically draw up agreements and contracts for each deal. Having said that, let's go through some of the standard option contract clauses. The first part of the option agreement is usually just setting out who the parties to the contract are. The second part is all the definitions and interpretations and what they mean. This can sometimes take up several pages. Due diligence clause. This is one of the most important clauses in the option contract agreement. The wording of this clause will determine whether you can get out of the option and subsequent sales contract if you choose, and whether any penalties can be levied. The wording of this clause is so important that it is the main reason that under no circumstances should you ever use a standard contract. Always have a lawyer specifically draft one for each deal. This way, if anything should go wrong, you will be covered by his professional indemnity insurance and the Law Society. Development application. This option contract agreement is subject to a DA being granted. However, this clause would be varied depending on your intentions for the property. Obligations pending exercise. This clause basically means that the seller must sell to you if you choose to exercise your option. Grant of call option. This clause deals with the payment of the option fee and may be extended to cover deposits paid in advance. Nominee. This clause enables you to determine at a later date who the ultimate purchaser will be. It also means that you are able to transfer the option ownership to a third party. Exercise of call option and call option contract. This section sets out the exact procedure you must follow to exercise your option and progress the contract. These procedures must be followed to the letter of the law and in the time frame set out in the option agreement. If there is any variation, then either party could cancel the option, which could mean significant losses. Call option fee. These all deal with the mechanics of how the option is to be treated. Power of attorney. This clause basically gives you the ability to lodge any necessary applications and documentation with the council in order for you to gain any development approval you may require. Caveat. This clause gives you the right to lodge a caveat on the property at any time and prevent the seller from selling the property to anybody else. Default. This deals with the procedures and penalties if default should occur. Costs of the agreement. This clause sets out who will pay for the legal fees associated with drawing up the agreement. Notices. This clause deals with how notices are given and received and the necessary timeframes. Proper law jurisdiction. This clause sets out which site and jurisdiction laws apply. General provisions. This clause deals with who signs and how the agreement will be executed and followed through. Timing. This is a clause that makes a general statement that all parties to the contract must do things in a timely fashion. Signing pages. The balance of the document is signing pages, annexures, and schedules to the contract. Timeframes and extensions. When dealing with third parties like financial institutions and councils that you have absolutely no control over, you need to be very mindful that you allow yourself enough time to get the necessary approvals through council or through the financing departments of institutions. I think the best policy is to double whatever time frame you think it may take. Then, if it comes sooner, happy days. Whenever you are doing any project, and scheduling an option deal is no different, it is a good idea to do a time schedule flowchart. A working digital version of a time schedule flowchart is on your Ultimate Real Estate Feasibility Program. If you haven't got your copy of this, and this is free to all Ultimate students, go to the website, listen to the training webinar, email in to the website at the end of this training webinar, and get your copy. Remember, when you install your copy, you have to register before it activates. The Ultimate Real Estate Feasibility Study Timeframe Flowchart also gives you the flexibility to be able to monitor actual to budgeted timeframes. Whilst the timeframe flowchart is your best efforts as to how long a project will take, if you had it 100% accurate first up, it would be very surprising. Therefore, make sure when you are preparing your option contract that you have allowed ample time to complete all the tasks you have listed. Gaining an extension to an option contract once it has been entered into is not always easy. It is totally at the discretion of the seller to agree. If you have spent your own time, money, and effort increasing the value of the seller's property, he may not be very willing to grant you an extension. A better policy is to give yourself plenty of time up front and exercise early if you can, but not be obliged to exercise your option on a partially completed project. Option fees, deposits in advance, stamp duty and tax. Isn't it strange how you don't know what you don't know until you know what you didn't know? The same applies to options. When you really understand their implementation and implications, they become just another tool in your armory. One of the clauses in an option contract covers how much you are paying as an option fee to secure the property. However, there is an added advantage for both parties because you pay stamp duty on the value of your option fee. With all due respect to the State Stamp Duty Office, no one likes paying stamp duty. What you want is for the option fee to be as low as possible, preferably $1. Of course, your seller is going to want more than a dollar to compensate them for taking the property off the market for the term of the option, because this effective compensation payment is usually released to them immediately. On the flip side, if that payment is called an option fee, it will be income tax assessable in the year they receive it, so they don't want that either. There is a sneaky way around this that benefits both parties. What you would do is pay an option fee of a dollar on which you would pay stamp duty and the seller would declare as income. You then pay to the seller a deposit in advance, which again is released to them immediately. This deposit in advance will form part of the settlement proceeds when the option is ultimately exercised. This way, there is no stamp duty to be paid at your end on this amount, and the seller does not have to declare it as income, but will have to declare it as part of the capital gain when settlement eventually occurs in the future. This is a much better solution all round. Selling an option to a third party. Let's assume you already have an option on a property and you have gone about increasing the value of that property by renovating, rezoning, gaining a DA or whatever, and you are now in a position to sell your option to someone else. This is where you exercise your nominee clause. What this means is that the option is transferable. So, effectively, you transfer your option to the new buyer for a fee, which is the sale price of your option. He or she then exercises the contract with the original owner. The new purchaser would pay stamp duty on the execution of the contract with the original owner and stamp duty on the sale price of the option contract from you. You, on the other hand, will pay income tax on the sale proceeds of the option. Any deposits in advance or option fees are usually released to the seller immediately and forfeited if you or a third party does exercise the option and does not proceed to settlement. Demographics and research for options. Successfully selecting a property suitable for a manufactured growth strategy and using an option to secure it is a process that relies on a systematic research and due diligence process common to all manufactured growth strategies. There are certain criteria to look for when targeting a property suitable for manufactured growth and therefore potentially suitable for taking out an option. Some of the fundamentals are as follows. 1. Population. Is the population in your target area increasing or decreasing or flatlining? Obviously, an increasing population gives rise to increasing demand and therefore adds upward pressure on prices. Thus, having an option at a fixed price that defers settlement to a date as far into the future as possible means you ride any upward pricing over that time. When determining what type or style of manufactured growth you should be implementing during the option period, ask yourself a few basic questions. Where is the population movement coming from? How long are they likely to stay? What style of housing do they demand? How quickly do you expect the market to move in response to these population movements? Government spending. Governments normally spend money on an area in response to expected demand. Look for which level of government is spending the money. Is it local, state, or federal? Which type of government spending generally has an impact on the site and nature of the expected growth? Look for the telltale signs such as regentrification of CBD and suburbs, infrastructure developments such as roads, ring roads, bridges, public transport, etc., departmental expenditure such as Centrelink departments, tax offices, state rail, public services and military, medical facilities. Look at what sized hospitals, aged care facilities, etc. are being put in and what is the future time frame of any expansions. Education facilities. Schools and universities are always good indications of future growth and expansion of an area. These types of facilities take time to build and normally give you a good gauge as to when the population growth can be expected. 3. Industry spending. Just like government spending, industry expenditure creates jobs and brings people into an area, thus increasing population and demand for housing. It places an upward pressure on pricing. Look for evidence of projects being granted approval and construction being started, and estimate the time frame for implementation. The media is normally a help here, as they tend to monitor the announcements of publicly listed companies on the ASX, who have to make public to their shareholders when such expansion is taking place or likely to take place. Mining. Mining is still a big growth area in Australia at present. The expansion of this industry as a whole is having a huge impact on regional towns as well as coastal ports and manufacturing areas. It is an industry to watch closely and to capitalise on. Manufacturing. This is not as strong an industry as mining, as our cost structure, predominantly labour, is too high. However, we do have a fledgling industry here, and it does have some impact on growth areas. Tourism. This industry has always been a strength industry for Australia, but since the global financial crisis, it has certainly copped a battering, which is why we see areas such as the Gold Coast, and to a lesser extent Cairns, both of which are predominantly reliant on tourism, going through an absolute bloodbath at present. It is all about jobs and timing. One quick analysis you can do that will give you an indication of depth and volume of a market is to look at days on the market, clearance rates, and variance between replacement and old. Without wasting much time, you will quickly see if an area is hot or not, and whether it is worthy of further investigation or not. Big hint. Go onto the State Development Board website, and in some states, the State Infrastructure website, and buy a laminated state infrastructure map. It will cost you around $27.50 in most states, and it is the best $27.50 you will have ever spent. They are updated periodically and list all state and federal funding projects, stating how much will be spent, how it will be spent, and over what time frame the money will be spent. It includes additional websites for further information. The maps also show most industry projects and infrastructure, both planned and underway. Again, it will list websites having more information.